Good evening and welcome to the local news. Today is Thursday, September 4th, and I'm Nat Cardos reporting for KMed. In tonight's news, power outage in Ferndale, fire updates on the Dillon Fire and the Blue Fire, Eureka struggles with state mandate for more housing, and Siskiyou Land Conservancy creates 353-acre riverfront reserve on Mad River. So stay tuned. Those stories and more coming up.
Redwood Community Radio acknowledges that its transmitter sites are located on the unceded territory of the Tsingkiyon, Wailaki, Wiyot, Wilcut, and Kato people. We honor ancestors past, present, and emerging, and acknowledge the ongoing cultural, spiritual, and physical connection these tribes have to this region.
At approximately 1:40 p.m. today, PG&E reported an unplanned outage in Ferndale that at its peak affected approximately 1,485 customers. As of broadcast, only approximately 170 customers are still affected. KMA News spoke with Megan McFarland, spokesperson for PG&E, for more information on the incident.
As soon as PG&E got the call, we sent a trouble worker, that's a PG&E first responder, sent him out to the scene. He arrived within 20 minutes, and he discovered that there was a PG&E wire that's normally overhead. It had come to the ground. So we immediately started working to make the area safe, assess what needed to be done, and started making repairs.
PG&E reported on their outage map that the expected time for the remaining 170 customers to get power back will be approximately 7:30 p.m. McFarland advises the public on what to do when there is a fallen wire, just like what happened today.
So, you know, this is a unique situation where there was a wire down, a wire on the ground, and we want to let customers know if you're ever out and about in your community and you see a wire down, stay away from it, assume that it's energized, call 911, call PG&E, and we'll come out and make the area safe.
For more information on updates on the outage, the website is pgealerts.alerts.pge/outage-tools. An update on the Dillon Fire in Six Rivers National Forest, followed by an update on the Blue Fire in Klamath National Forest. The Dillon Fire is currently at 9,375 acres and 21% contained. There are currently 1,558 personnel on scene. Yesterday, the fire grew to 9,100 acres, but containment also grew. KMA News spoke with Paul Mesnerick, Public Information Officer for both the Dillon and the Blue Fires, for more information.
Yesterday, we saw the fire have some moderate growth towards the west, but the east part of the fire, that's the fire that's closer to structures and impacting people. The firefighters were really successful at holding the eastern line and keeping that property and those structures safe. So part of what that entailed operationally, we have a spot fire on the east side of the Klamath River. It had spotted a few days ago, and we were really concerned about that one spreading further east just because, again, it has that potential to impact homes and structures. But what made that particular spot so challenging is it was just on super steep terrain, so it's really hard to get people on that slope to actually address the fire. So for the most part, we were just hammering it with aircraft, just dropping water, just to kind of keep that fire at bay. But eventually, we were able to get hand line kind of around that perimeter and tie it into the river. And then for extra security, we did a firing operation. And so what we'll do is we'll actually light off narrow bands of vegetation so that way the fire doesn't get too big or too hot or move too quickly. And we'll just sort of like slowly back that fire down to the river. So what that does is it removes available vegetation or fuel that the fire could otherwise have used to grow too hot or too big or run too fast. So we kind of take the wind out of the fire's sails. And so by kind of increasing that line of black, reducing the amount of fuel for that fire to try and make a run to the east, you know, we hope that that's going to help secure that area and prevent the fire from moving beyond that boundary into those structures. So that was a big part of what we did yesterday. You know, some other spotting that's occurred has been north of Dillon Creek. And the reason why there's been spotting is the area has been receiving wind predominantly out of the south. And so it's blowing spots anywhere from a quarter of a mile up to a mile and a half to the north. What's fortunate about this particular incident is directly north of Dillon Creek, there was actually a fire there that had burned that area back in 2023, the Elliott Fire. And so even though we have some spot fires in that area north of Dillon Creek, they're not causing a lot of problem. Like, they're finding some, like, isolated pockets of vegetation, burning those, throwing up some smoke. But because there's not a lot of vegetation because of that 2013 burn, those fires really aren't going anywhere. They're not really causing much problems. So, you know, anytime a fire spots, we watch it and monitor it. We're just fortunate that in that particular location, it's kind of containing itself because of the vegetation or the lack thereof around it.
It is possible that there will be intermittent closures of Highway 96, particularly near Sayed Valley. Road updates can be found on the Caltrans website, dot.ca.gov/travel. There are currently evacuation orders and warnings in place for the Dillon Fire. These can be found at protect.genesis.com. That's protect.genasys.com. Shelter information and evacuation resources can be found through the Siskiyou County Office of Emergency Services at 530-340-3539. And now the Blue Fire. The Blue Fire is currently at 2,055 acres and is 0% contained. There are currently 506 personnel on scene. There are also evacuation orders and warnings in place for the Blue Fire that can be found at protect.genesis.com. Here's Mesnerick with more information on the Blue Fire.
Our main focus on the Blue Fire is just protecting those structures. The fire has been making this gradual progression north towards Sayed Valley, and there's also structures to its east in Walker Creek. And so a lot of our attention has just been focusing on, you know, getting hoses and digging fire line around those structures. So as the fire moves north, because the winds have generally been pushing the fire in that direction, we're trying to provide as much protection to those homes as possible. So far, things are holding. The fire hasn't come down to the community yet, but like I say, it's on that trajectory, and so that's our focus, is trying to protect those homes and structures. And then one other thing that people should be mindful of with the Blue Fire, that is impacting the Pacific Crest Trail. So the Pacific Crest Trail is currently closed between the junction with the Kelsey National Recreation Trail and Sayed Valley. So it's a pretty popular thoroughfare for hikers, and it is being impacted because of the fire. So people using the trail or wanting to recreate on it should be checking those recreation resources to see what's open and what's closed, because as the fire grows and moves, those closures can also fluctuate as well.
The Pacific Crest Trail, PCT, is closed between the junction with Kelsey National Recreation Trail and Sayed Valley due to the Blue Fire. Southbound long-distance hikers on the PCT should not continue south of Mount Ashland in Oregon. For closure information for the PCT, the website is closures.pcta.org. KMUN News will continue to bring updates on fires during this 2025 fire season. Last month, the Siskiyou Land Conservancy acquired two riverfront properties on the Bottawat, also known as the Mad River, to create a 353-acre nature reserve. The Mad River is home to several protected species. The Mad River is home to several protected species in Humboldt, including coho salmon, rare summer runs of steelhead trout, lamprey, and more. The river also provides domestic water for 70% of Humboldt County residents. KMUN News spoke with Greg King, Executive Director of the Siskiyou Land Conservancy, for more information about the land acquisition.
The acquisition is really special, and it started out in a special way as well, when one of our directors, Ken Miller, who's a longtime environmental activist here and a physician, very well known, he donated his beautiful 183-acre property on the lower middle reach of the Mad River above Maple Creek. And he donated it to Siskiyou Land Conservancy, you know, to permanently protect it. And it's a really gorgeous piece of land. It's got mature 80-year-old second growth Douglas fir forest and enormous maples and a lot of wildlife, bears, mountain lions, the gamut. And it also had a half mile of river frontage where there's quite a bit of, you know, the salmon habitat and steelhead and western pond turtles, etc., river otters, on and on. It's really got the full range of habitat there in that area. And so he donated the property not just to protect it, but also to inspire others to step forward and consider protecting their properties on the Mad River. As a lot of us know, in the famous Six Rivers area, the Mad is the least protected of all those six rivers. And there's almost no reserves, you know, inviolable reserves of riverfront of any size on the Mad River. And so with the donation, we then connected with the neighbor, the downstream neighbor, who owned 170 acres with a mile of river frontage. And so we negotiated with that owner for 6 months. We were able to also secure a $275,000 grant from the Vincent J. Coates Foundation, and we are so thankful for that. And we were able to purchase another incredible piece of land with wonderful habitat and really connect it to the first piece of land and create this 353-acre riverfront reserve on the Mad, which is, again, the least protected of the six rivers and provides, you know, 80,000 people in Humboldt County with their domestic water. So we look at this as the beginning of a program to really offer landowners the opportunity to somehow offer some environmental protection to the land, to conservation easement, through donation of the land or, you know, acquisition of the land. And that I want to emphasize also that we're not actually talking about necessarily taking land out of, quote, production. Some landowners have reservations about, you know, I don't want to have forest restoration work on my land stopped. You know, a lot of thinning is going on out there on these private properties and provides good employment and things like that. And so, for instance, on the new parcel, it's very densely stocked with mostly Douglas fir regeneration. And so we're embarking right now talking with state and federal government about funding to restore that property. And when we did this on the Smith River, we hired crews of a dozen people who would come in and work for weeks. We did this for 15 years on a property we manage up there and restored more than 100 acres of Douglas fir habitat. And that's been wonderful. So we hope to emulate that somewhat on the Mad. But the most important thing to us is to protect water quality and habitat on that river.
The Siskiyou Land Conservancy is a land trust that operates out of Mendocino, Humboldt, and Del Norte counties. The Conservancy was founded in 2004 with the goal of creating a land trust that would take title to and hold conservation easements on private properties not served by other land trusts, which since then they've been successful in. Out of the six rivers on the California North Coast, Bottawatt remains one of the least protected. The riverfront reserve created by the Conservancy is now the longest fully protected stretch on the entire 113-mile-long Mad River. King explains the importance of this and the protection of this ecosystem.
Yeah, the importance of this is that it just doesn't exist anywhere else on the Mad. This riverfront reserve, and it's small, you know, but it's a mile and a half of riverfront. There's a wonderful conservation easement upstream of this area that was done by North Coast Regional Land Trust. I think it's like 18,000 acres or 16, just off the top of my head. But in any case, that, you know, what that doesn't do is alleviate the stresses of heavy logging and ranching on that land. What it does is prevent subdivision, and that's really highly valuable. And the work of North Coast Regional is very important to our region. But we look at this acquisition, these two acquisitions, as the beginning of something a little different, where it really remains inviolable to excessive resource extraction. And we plan to create a trail system through the two properties and have limited public access on a permit basis. It won't be a park. It won't be a big place where people can go. We don't want to upset our neighbors in that way, right? It's all private out there. But we will have a permitted access mechanism so that the public can visit this part of the Mad River with these astounding pools and cliffs, waterfalls that they don't ever see. So that's a big part of our objective here, is to provide this other quality for the public here in Humboldt County.
The point of nature preserves is to protect ecosystems by minimizing human interference, though this doesn't mean minimizing maintenance. The Conservancy will be working on maintaining the land and water quality, as well as allowing limited public access on a permit basis. King elaborates on common misunderstandings on how nature preserves operate and the significance of maintaining ecological health in Humboldt County.
I think a great misunderstanding is that somehow the wealth of Humboldt County, you know, forever has been come from the land, you know, whether it was logging, the fisheries, cannabis, you know, from the land. And we emphasize is that there's another form of wealth, and that is the public trust wealth. And that would be the water quality, and that would be the habitat for all the creatures that need it. And when we have those pieces intact as well as the economic wealth generators in our area, then we are all the richer. We can't have one without the other, right? We've seen what happens when there's large-scale clear-cutting or even, you know, heavy industrial cannabis use with production with chemicals and whatever it is, right? Anything that's not done correctly. So logging can be done correctly. We point to the Arcata Community Forest as the best redwood logging in the world, and we support that as an organization. And so you have to really look at the components of habitat and protecting these other creatures that really make up the basis of our own existence in order to ensure also a healthy economy. We believe believe that very strongly, and statistically, that is true around the world. So I think that's a misunderstanding, is that somehow, you know, this takes away from the ability to generate income or to have, you know, a viable society or something. It really doesn't. The more land you preserve for habitat and some, you know, like working forests or fisheries or whatever, the richer your area is. And we have a lot of land here. And I'll just say that, especially on the Mad River, which is almost entirely privately owned, we, I think, have an obligation to address the inability to work through state and federal governments on, you know, on protecting their land, which up in the upper reaches of the Mad we do. But really, we have to reach out and work with private landowners on the Mad in particular, because that's where it's at in terms of protecting habitat.
For more information about the Siskiyou Land Conservancy, the website is siskiyouland.org. The state's new housing requirements pose a dilemma for Eureka. Daniel Mintz reports.
Eureka faces what's described as an intimidating challenge as it plans for meeting a state-mandated housing goal that is nearly double a previous target. During the September 2nd City Council meeting, Community Development Director Kristen Kenyon presented the state's new regional housing needs assessment numbers, with the Humboldt County region required to plan for 5,962 new housing units by 2035. That's a 76% increase from the previous eight-year cycle. As designated by the Humboldt County Association of Governments, Eureka's proposed share is 1,740 new units, a big jump from the 952 it was assigned in the last cycle. Development isn't required to happen during the new cycle, but the city has to demonstrate through its zoning and land use policies that there's a viable plan to accommodate the growth. But one of the state's main criteria for accommodation of housing is the presence of vacant, developable properties, and Kenyon said that's challenging in Eureka.
Eureka really struggles to identify adequate sites for a few key reasons. Number one, the easiest way to demonstrate compliance is to just identify vacant sites, which is counter to the state's goal of infill development. But it's hard for built-out cities because we don't have very many vacant unconstrained parcels. Because we don't have that, we need to rely on non-vacant sites, and there's a higher bar for those. You have to prove there's realistic and demonstrated capacity for redevelopment. And we don't have the type of market demand that other built-out cities like Berkeley might have.
The drastic increase is driven by some new state adjustments, including what's known as a cost burden adjustment. That's based on a finding that 42% of Humboldt County's households spend more than 30% of income on housing. For the first time, the state is figuring in levels of homelessness. Eureka and the region also have housing vacancy rates low enough to be considered unhealthy, adding more units to the mandate. Council members grasped for words to describe the situation, with Councilmember Katie Moulton referring to it as terrifying before taking it back. Grasping for the most appropriate terminology, Councilmember Mario Fernandez discussed the situation in this exchange with Kenyon.
Thank you for the enlightening, terrifying might be the wrong word, but onerous, responsible, intimidating, projects that we have on the horizon there. And so, in a sense, it feels like we're being punished for having centralized industry in Humboldt, and that's in Eureka. And so, is it a state issue then? Is it a legislative issue? Because it feels like we're limited by the space that we have.
I think it stinks that you prove compliance by pointing to vacant sites, and that's what you need to do. Like, I prefer what we had to do for the pro-housing designation, which is it looked at what was in the city's control, you know, reducing regulatory barriers, providing financial, and you got a certain number, you got points for each of the little things that you did, and then your points had to add up to a certain number of points to qualify as pro-housing.
Failure to comply with the state's housing element laws would result in severe penalties. The city could be switched to a more demanding four-year housing element cycle, lose out on critical state grants for housing and transportation projects, and face significant financial penalties if sued by the state. But Councilmember Scott Bauer questioned whether the 1,740-unit mandate is doable.
The analysis that I would like to see before we're given some kind of allotment at the HCOG level is, can we physically build 1,740? I mean, we have an inventory. You know, we know where our vacancies are. We know where we have existing buildings. But can we physically do it given our space? Does anybody know that? And if we don't, we need to figure that out.
We can. I mean, we zoned our downtown for 10 stories. But I've only had people pushing back against our minimum of 2 stories. Like, there's no market demand for a 10-story building at this point. Nobody's trying to build that.
The final decision on the housing allocation methodology will be made by the Humboldt County Association of Governments in the coming months, with the city's updated housing element due in mid-2027. Also at the meeting, the council unanimously approved a partnership with the Blue Lake Rancheria to explore the potential for redeveloping a long-neglected section of the city's waterfront. The city is entering into a Memorandum of Understanding agreement with the Rancheria, a prerequisite for the tribe to apply for federal funding to analyze the potential for redevelopment of what's known as Dock B, a city-owned dock that's been reduced to pilings after earthquakes and fires over the years. Sierra Emery, Director of Strategic Initiatives for the Rancheria, said the tribe views the grant pursuit as an opportunity to, quote, realize what tribal sovereignty and tribal economics might mean in a port setting. The ultimate outcome would be a disposition and development agreement between the city and the tribe to rebuild the dock. The council's approval opens the door for the Rancheria to submit its grant application with a September 8th deadline. In Eureka for KMUD News, this is Daniel Mintz.
In National Native News, Antonia Gonzalez reads today's headlines.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A case is ongoing in Wisconsin over a legal challenge to key permits for a project to reroute an oil and gas pipeline around a Lake Superior tribe's reservation. As Danielle Kading reports, Canadian energy firm Enbridge wants to build a new stretch of its Line 5 pipeline.
Enbridge proposed the reroute after the Bad River Tribe sued to shut down the pipeline on tribal lands. Now the tribe and environmental groups are challenging the state's decision to issue a wetland and waterway permit, among other approvals for the project. They say the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources lacked baseline data about the project's effects on wetlands. At the first hearing, Bad River Tribal Chair Robert Blanchard said a potential spill could spell disaster for the tribe's homeland.
It's going to affect our way of life, and that's why we are fighting this so hard.
Enbridge spokesperson Jennifer Smith said they designed the route to minimize harm.
We believe that the Wisconsin DNR's permits are accurate, they're correct. We can build this pipeline with minimal environmental impact.
The reroute would cross nearly 200 waterways and disturb around 100 acres of wetlands. Supporters say it would create 700 jobs, but opponents question the company's environmental track record. A DNR attorney says it properly permitted the project under the law. For National Native News, I'm Danielle Kading.
Efforts in New Mexico have been relaunched to find about 150 tribal items stolen in 1984. Earlier this year, a bowl stolen from the Santa Ana Pueblo ceremonial village was returned. Monica Morrell, director of the Santa Ana Historic Preservation Department, says that led investigators to look for more leads on other items.
We have right around a dozen objects that we have very close connections.
Items that are at least a century old are considered antiquities and protected under the Archaeological Resources Protection Act. And in 2022, Congress passed legislation prohibiting the export of items held sacred by tribes. Tributes continue to pour in for Canadian Indigenous actor Graham Greene. He died on Monday of natural causes. He was 73. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, for many critics, Green had a groundbreaking career.
Green was an Oneida from the Six Nations Reserve in Ontario. Among those who paid tribute to his work was actor Kevin Costner, who described him as a master at work and a wonderful human being. It was with Costner that Green was nominated for an Academy Award for the film Dances with Wolves. Costner posted one of his favorite scenes from the movie when Green played the part of Kicking Bird, a Sioux medicine man.
Tatanka.
Tatanka.
Right here. Tatanka.
Dances with Wolves was his big break, and Green wasn't going to look back.
I'll be damned if anybody's going to push me off this heap. You know, I'm going to fight as hard as I can to stay there and get more writers, more actors, more storytellers, more film crews. You know, anybody in the technical end to seriously get on board.
And that followed with several roles in movies and television. The Stratford Festival in Ontario also paid tribute to Green, who played Shylock in the 2007 production of The Merchant of Venice and Lenny in John Steinbeck's Of Mice and Men. Green was also honored with the Governor General's Performing Arts Award for Lifetime Artistic Achievement. Governor General Mary Simons said he brought dignity to every character he portrayed. She said he broke barriers for Indigenous actors and opened doors for future generations. And we honor his extraordinary contributions, she said, to Canadian culture and celebrate a legacy that will resonate across Canada and beyond. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thanks for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Dennis Marr, and thanks to our reporters, Daniel Mintz and Antonia Gonzalez. KMUD News is online, and you can find us at kmud.org and now streaming on most podcast platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify, where you can download our stories and newscasts for offline listening during your rural commutes. You can also follow us on social media. If you have questions or suggestions, you can give us a call at 707-923-2605. Or send an email to news@kmud.org. Are you passionate about your community? Looking to report what's happening around Mendocino? KMUD News is looking for stringer reporters in the Mendocino area to cover local Mendocino stories that matter. Whether you're a seasoned journalist or just eager to learn, we'll help you get started. You'll get training, support, and a chance to amplify real voices from around your community. If you're interested, email news@kmud for more information. Redwood Community Radio, Inc. is funded by Press Forward, the national movement to strengthen communities by reinvigorating local news. Learn more at pressforward.news. Reporting for KMUD, I'm Matt Cardos.